From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The second week after the presidential election is drawing to a close, and there is still no certainty as to who exactly won. Nevertheless, the media is sure, and anyone who challenges that is in for some big trouble. RT's Caleb Maupin has more.
Questioning the U.S. election results is tantamount to sacrilege. The media is outraged that anyone would talk about ballot fraud, especially this New York Times columnist.
Facebook is absolutely teeming with right-wing misinformation right now.
Right-wing misinformation. So what is this misinformation that he feels is so dangerous and unacceptable?
What indeed? The article references a Daily Wire piece, which headlines Republican in Michigan goes from loser to winner after, quote, technical glitch, close quote, fixed. Officials urge, quote, confidence, close quote, in system. It also references a Breitbart headline, Attorney General William Barr authorizes DOJ to look into voting irregularities. It also references a headline from the Dan Bongino show, Michigan legislature holds rare emergency session to investigate possible election irregularities. And finally, one other headline from Breitbart where the two Republican candidates for Senate in Georgia call on the Secretary of State to resign over what they called election mismanagement. Back to Caleb.
Well, perhaps the reason that this information is deemed to be so dangerous is because those headlines are actually true. And what about this guy?
Second Pennsylvania USPS whistleblower claims postmaster ordered late ballots picked up and separated.
Well, the Washington Post came forward and said this is all a big hoax, that the postal worker has recanted his story. Well, that's a great journalistic expose, except the postal worker says he has not recanted.
I'm here to say that I did not recant my statements.
Head of the Republican National Committee says they have 234 pages containing 500 signed affidavits alleging 11,000 incidents of potential voter fraud.
Now you have a media that's rigging it again by saying we're not going to even listen to these stories. We're not even going to validate the 11,000 incident reports that we have, the 500 affidavits we have across these states.
11,000 witnesses is not a small number. Now in Georgia, the Senate runoff elections are coming up. And another New York Times columnist has this idea.
Oh, I hope everybody moves to Georgia, you know, in the next a month or two, registers to vote and votes for these two Democratic senators.
Well, in Georgia, that is actually a felony. It is illegal to move to Georgia simply for the purpose of registering to vote. Only people in Georgia with established residency are able to vote. Republicans have a lot of questions about the election results that show Joe Biden as the clear winner. Now, at this point, we've got mainstream media saying those questions are simply off limits. However, that seems to be making the Trump base even more emboldened. Caleb Maupin, RT, New York.
But there does seem to be some cracks forming in the edifice surrounding the claim that Biden is the president-elect. Among those was an article in Thursday's edition of USA Today about the Trump campaign's challenge of election results in Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Arizona. The piece argues that Trump raising these claims is somehow harmful to the U.S. In it is a quote from Chris Edelson, a government professor at American University, lawyer, and fellow at the Center for Congressional and Presidential Studies, who said the harm in letting the lawsuits play out is that, quote, it's not impossible that they will succeed, closed quote. In other words, the wall-to-wall reporting that Trump's allegations are not supported by any proof may not be true. Meanwhile, the demand that Trump stop the litigation and hand over the keys to the White House in the interest of national security is being challenged on the grounds of fairness, given the activities of the Democrats over the past 4 years. RT's Daniel Hawkins has more on that.
Heated rhetoric, fierce debates, and downright insults in the run-up to the election, one thing remained untouchable: the integrity of the vote counting process and certification.
Vice President Biden, final question for you. Will you urge your supporters to stay calm while the vote is counted, and will you pledge not to declare victory until the election is independently certified?
Yes.
But as the race went neck and neck, with supporters on both sides claiming victory was within their grasp, the rules of the game changed.
Sir, what do you say to the Americans that are anxious over the fact that President Trump has yet to concede and what that might mean for the country?
Well, I just think it's an embarrassment.
Baseless claims by the president and his supporters that there's been widespread voter fraud and that the election was somehow rigged or stolen from President Trump. That kind of rhetoric is extremely dangerous, extremely poisonous to our democracy.
If I were an intelligence analyst in a foreign country looking at the United States, I'd be writing up that it's slow slide into autocracy.
There was a time when Democrats saw things differently, and their candidates lost by more electoral college votes than this election was viewed as an injustice.
As I've been telling candidates who have come to see me, you can run the best campaign, you can even become the nominee, and you can have the election stolen from you.
The Kremlin was allegedly behind that election result, helping Trump to power. Several years and millions of dollars later, an investigation concluded there was no criminal conspiracy. Yet, now that Biden is projected to win, the results are accepted at face value. And this time, the presidency was apparently won fair and square.
All we've seen so far in the U.S. is the mainstream media, which of course has been behind Joe Biden 1,000%, declaring on their own that Joe Biden is the president-elect. The Democratic Party for 4 years has still not conceded that Hillary Clinton lost in 2016. No matter what they did, no matter how they tried to steal the election from Trump at the time, they invented Russiagate to try to first undermine then-candidate Donald Trump, but then when Trump won, to undermine his presidency. It's a bunch of hypocrisy and it's a bunch of lies from the Democrats.
But even if Biden didn't win, the Democrats had a backup plan. No surrender.
Joe Biden should not concede under any circumstances because I think this is going to drag out. And eventually, I do believe he will win if we don't give an inch.
Now the tables are turned. With Trump refusing to concede, his opponents are willing to go to just about any lengths to see the back of him.
Vice President Pence and the cabinet had an ounce of fortitude and spine and patriotism, I think they would seriously consider invoking the 25th Amendment and, you know, pushing Donald Trump out.
And calls from the Democrats, who spent almost the entire term looking for evidence the election was stolen, for Trump to accept defeat and move on, look like double standards at best.
Let's not have any lectures, no lectures about how the president should immediately, cheerfully accept preliminary election results from the same characters who just spent 4 years refusing to accept the validity of the last election, and who insinuated that this one would be illegitimate too.
Meanwhile, all of this is being viewed around the world. That includes China. Beijing's English language China's global television network featured this report from Elaine Reyes, who spoke with Mary C. Curtis, a columnist at Roll Call and the Op-Ed Project, about the U.S. election.
Well, he hasn't been saying much. He's been not really having any public pronouncements. Mainly, he's operating on Twitter. He is denying the results, obviously, of the election. He has these lawsuits, and he's claiming fraud, although I have to emphasize, there is no indication of widespread voter fraud. So you see him out doing this, but obviously he had a fraught relationship with the military, and he just recently fired the head of the Defense Department, his defense secretary, and quite a few people at the Pentagon. So it is an odd juxtaposition on Veterans Day.
And staying on these big changes at the Pentagon behind the scenes, we're seeing this. Is the United States safe or is it vulnerable right now? I mean, how worried should people be about those leadership changes at the Pentagon?
Well, a lot of national security people are saying that this is a fraught time because why are you having instability and also a refusal to help with the transition? At this time 4 years ago, we already saw the then President Barack Obama have President-elect Donald Trump to the White House, and the team was trying to make the transition smooth. So there are warnings that if any of our adversaries are looking at this country that they love times of instability. So, yes, there are worries coming out of the national security cohort in Washington.
And regarding some of the vote counting still taking place across the United States, the Georgia Secretary of State announced earlier today a full hand recount of some 5 million votes. Other states still counting. Do you think we'll learn anything more by any of this? Any concerns that you anticipate in the coming weeks?
Not really, because Joe Biden won by a pretty large margin, larger than Donald Trump won by. And we're talking tens of thousands of votes. And usually the recounts only change them maybe a few hundred. So this really is more of a stalling tactic. And I believe that if people are humoring Donald Trump and Republicans, he's still quite the most popular Republican, and they do not want to cross him. So they're going through this, but I do not see a change. At January 20th of next year, we do have President-elect Biden and Vice President-elect Kamala Harris, but it allows him to leave and say, it wasn't my fault because they cheated. But there's no indication that they cheated.
Meanwhile, Joe Biden is continuing to work on this transition. He sounds pretty confident, but is there a point where we could see that change? I mean, if there is not an official transition period, you know, Biden, he's been in office before. This is not a big surprise. He could bring some people back. I mean, is there any issues when it comes to an actual transition between administrations?
Well, he's trying to project that calm because he ran as a unifier. But at some point, basically, yes, he will need to get the funds to move into offices, the passwords, to keep government going. Now, most of the electors by early December, will file and officially certify the race. And at that point, you will have a president-elect Biden. And then I think you will see some Republicans really basically tell the president that he has to accept the results. But as of now, you've had more foreign leaders congratulate Joe Biden than you have had U.S. Republican senators.
And what is the one big thing that you will be watching in the days and weeks ahead?
Well, we know that one reason they're doing this is because of Georgia. We have two runoff Senate elections coming in January, and there's going to be an incredible amount of money because it will determine the who will control the Senate. And so between the recount and these new Senate races, these runoffs, all eyes will be on Georgia, which unexpectedly, because of the efforts of so many grassroots groups, including folks like Stacey Abrams, it turned a shade of blue, and nobody saw that coming, or the people on the ground did. So I think you'll be seeing coming up Georgia, Georgia, Georgia.
Meanwhile, Thursday was a busy day at UN headquarters in New York. This was Stefan Dujarric, spokesperson for the Secretary General, at his regular press conference in New York on Thursday.
COVID-19 pandemic, the Secretary General said that we must not forget about 3/4 of new infectious diseases are zoonotic. By destroying the ecosystems, he added, we weaken the biological barriers that will keep these viruses at bay, and we ourselves weaken our coping skills. He called for the integration of climate and environmental action into stimulus packages to rebuild sustainable and inclusive economies and societies. He also addressed another session of the forum, but this time by video message, called Finance in Common Summit. He said that public development banks are uniquely positioned to play a leading role in the world's transformation towards carbon neutrality, added that they can also help build the foundation of a new economy fit for the 21st century. The Secretary General said he counts on public development banks to come to the Climate Ambition Summit in December and COP26 next year with concrete plans to realize our vision for a carbon neutral, resilient, inclusive, and sustainable world. Full remarks are online. And he spoke live at the G77 meeting this morning, the annual ministerial meeting. He said that we are at a historic moment and we face the greatest test of global solidarity in a generation, adding that COVID-19 pandemic continues to inflict unprecedented harm on people, societies, and economies around the world. But within this crisis lies an opportunity, a chance to embark on a path to revive economies, ensure gender equality, protect our planet, and achieve the sustainable development goals. His full remarks have been shared with you. For her part, the Deputy Secretary General is continuing her trip to West Africa. She's now in Mali, where she currently is meeting with the Prime Minister and other government officials. Earlier in the day in Niger, Amina Mohamed saw the impact of climate change when she visited sites impacted by some of the worst floods in the country's history. The UN is working with the government of Niger and our NGO partners to build resilience, reinforce adaptation measures, and for affected communities. The Deputy Secretary General spoke with relocated families and members of a fisheries community near the capital, Niamey. Ms. Mohamed also met with a group of girl entrepreneurs who are supported by the UN Population Fund, and she had a second follow-up visit with President Mamadou Issoufou before leaving Mali, And an update on Ethiopia. Our humanitarian colleagues are telling us that they're increasingly concerned over the protection of civilians due to fighting in Tigray. There are reports of civilians moving within Tigray as well as to neighboring Amhara region in search of protection, but we do not have the details. We're also alarmed by already large numbers of Ethiopian asylum seekers who have crossed into Sudan fleeing the hostilities or out of fear of an attack. Food, health, and other supplies are in warehouses awaiting loading for immediate delivery in Tigray. In addition, concerns over disrupted humanitarian aid to more than 2 million people in Tigray. There's also rising worry about the inability to assess additional humanitarian needs that are likely to spike. The humanitarian coordinator in Ethiopia, Catherine Sozi, is engaging with the government of Ethiopia and others at the highest levels to facilitate immediate and unimpeded humanitarian access. We, along with our partners, are repeating our call for full access to reach people in need, as well as to conduct needs assessments. We're also calling for the safe passage for civilians in search of safety and assistance, and to guarantee security for all aid workers. And we're also calling on the federal and regional authorities to enable humanitarian access to reach people in need in areas under their respective control. And we are committed to staying and delivering humanitarian assistance. The acting special representative for Libya, Stephanie Williams, said that we've had a breakthrough in the Libyan Political Dialogue Forum that's taking place in Tunis. She said the forum's participants had reached a preliminary agreement on a roadmap for ending the transitional period and organizing free, fair, and inclusive and credible parliamentary presidential elections. They outlined the clear steps for reaching these elections, including agreements on constitutional basis. According to the process they outlined, elections will be held in no more than 18 months, she added. The roadmap also outlined steps for uniting Libyan institutions, restoring public service, and beginning a process of national reconciliation and transitional justice. Ms. Williams added, at the same time, that we are under no illusion, and we note that a lot of work remains to be done. Also, I think Stefano has been asking about the plight of the fishermen detained in Libya, and I can tell you that we, of course, remain concerned of their fate. The UN mission in Libya has received a request from the families to help establish contact with the detainees. We are following up in close consultations with the relevant authorities, and we hope the situation will be resolved and that the detainees will be released as soon as possible. A quick update from Central America, where on the follow-up of the hurricane that hit the region in Honduras, the UN Migration Agency has delivered more than 39,000 personal protection items in an effort to mitigate the impact of the pandemic, as well as other items. And Nicaragua IOM has also, in coordination with local NGOs, will assist with the delivery of food kits and hygiene kits. And in Mexico, they're also distributing humanitarian aids in the Chiapas region. And from Cambodia, I can tell you that we, along with our humanitarian partners, have launched a flood response plan calling for more than $9 million to help some 237,000 of the most vulnerable people for the next 6 months. Since the beginning of October, Cambodia has been hit has been hit by widespread flooding following a number of tropical storms. More than 2 million people have reportedly been exposed to flooding. Some 800,000 have been directly impacted. Livelihoods of more than 175,000 households have also been negatively impacted. And the Philippines can tell you that we are working. The initial reports indicate that massive flooding and landslides in several areas of Luzon Island, at least 170,000 people in the affected areas have been evacuated, adding to nearly 83,000 still displaced from the earlier Typhoon Goni last week. We, along with our partners, are supporting the government-led response efforts by providing drinking water, food and shelter materials, and we are ready to assist in conducting rapid needs assessment. Quick note from Kazakhstan, where our country team is working under the leadership of their new resident coordinator, Michaela Freiberg-Story, to help the government deal with the impact of the pandemic. The World Health Organization is discussing Kazakhstan's participation in the COVAX mechanism, which, as you know, aims to speed up the search for an effective vaccine for all countries. And WHO is also providing for the government with new lockdown measures in place. Together, UNICEF and WHO are holding seminars on the use of personal protective equipment, immunization, infection prevention and control, as well as the safe reopening of schools. The UN team procured over $500,000 worth of critical health supplies. During the lockdown, more than 4,600 migrants and victims of human trafficking also received direct support from IOM. And last month alone, the UN team reached some 13 million people with messages on how to prevent the spread of the virus, which is helping curb the spread of misinformation. Just to flag that UNCTAD today, the UN Conference on Trade and Development, says that maritime trade will plunge by 4.1% in 2020 due to unprecedented disruption caused by the pandemic. They warn that new waves of the virus spreading could further disrupt supply chains and economies might cause a steeper decline. The report also decries the humanitarian and safety crisis caused by the pandemic, when more than 300,000 seafarers have been stranded at sea for months beyond the end of their contract. We reiterate our call to authorities to designate seafarers as key workers and exempt them from COVID-19 travel restrictions. And you may have seen the High Representative for the Alliance of Civilization, Miguel Angel Moratinos, yesterday condemned in the strongest terms the cowardly attack that wounded at least three people during a ceremony organized by the French consulate at a ceremony in Jeddah. And the full statement was shared with you. And lastly, the UN mission in Central African Republic is telling us that today we're continuing to provide multifaceted support to the electoral process in the country. This support ranges from good offices and political engagement to security, operational and technical assistance to ensure successful elections. The National Assembly Authority, Election Authority, has received 22 applications for the presidency, including from one woman, former transition president Catherine Samba Panza. They also received over 1,000 candidacies for the legislative elections, including 153 women. The Constitutional Court is expected to issue a ruling on the validity of those candidacies by December 3rd, first round of elections, December 27th. Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Anyway, first then on Libya and on the statement that you put out from Stephanie Williams. Mm-hmm. The plan, I think, originally was for the UN to organise these elections. Mm-hmm. And clearly we're now getting closer to elections maybe taking place in 2021. What is the UN offering?
Well, we will offer obviously, whatever support the Libyans are needed. The discussions are obviously still continuing, but we will be there to accompany the Libyans and assess exactly what the needs are for the elections.
So will it be a UN-organized election? Will you provide security, peacekeepers at polling stations? Will you provide the monitoring?
I think it's a little early. I don't believe there will be UN-organized elections, but let me get more details on for you on that.
And separately on Libya, sadly, again, a shipwreck of migrants, 74 currently reported dead. Do you have more for us?
I mean, we have seen these tragedies repeat over and over again of people trying to flee Libya. There needs to be, I think, frankly, greater empathy for the plight of these women, men, and children who are seeking a better life. Part of the solution, obviously, involves dealing with the situation in Libya and making it safer. But it is clear that we have a long way to go on that. Though what happened today was a big step forward, but it also underscores the need for better global management of migration and refugee routes. Yes, sir.
Hi, Steph. Thanks very much. Two questions for you today. First one is on Ethiopia and what we're seeing in Tigray. Is the UN involved at a political level in this conflict? And if so, what are they doing?
On Tigray, I think, as we've said, the Secretary General has offered his good offices in a conversation with President Abiy, as we said earlier this week. Our special envoy on the ground, Mr. Parfait Onyanga Nyanga, remains in contact with key players, but it would not be correct to say that we are involved in any negotiations at this time.
Are you hopeful for a resolution of this conflict, insofar as what your work is doing? Are you working towards facilitating negotiations or anything like that?
You know, listen, we will be, as I said, the Secretary General has offered his good offices. Our primary concern right now, as we've been underscoring, is on the humanitarian situation. As we've been saying from here, there's a lack of access, there's a lack of information. The fact that we understand that banks have been closed will have a devastating impact on the economy. Already in that area, you have not only internally displaced Ethiopians, but you also have Eritrean refugees. And the greater instability in Ethiopia is a risk of putting the whole region at risk.
Thank you. And the second question, how concerned is...
I have a follow-up.
One second, Abdelhamid.
I just wanted to ask if you're concerned that President Trump has not yet conceded the U.S. election.
I think, as we've said from here, we have full faith in the U.S. institutions. Abdelhamid.
Yeah, I have a follow-up to the same question my colleague asked about Tigray. Sudan said that at least 12,000 refugees had already crossed the border to Sudan, and they're expecting the number to reach 200,000. Is the UN prepared to do something about this?
Yes, I think as we flagged it from here, our colleagues on the ground are already in touch. They've been dealing with the authorities in Sudan. They're obviously very concerned about the impact on the situation, but we've already had, and we've reported here yesterday, reports of people crossing the border. Okay. Any other questions? Mr. Bays.
Yes, returning to Hong Kong, there's been criticism of the ouster of the lawmakers by the EU and the UK now. China has itself criticized those lawmakers who have resigned in response. Does the Secretary General have a comment on the situation?
I think you asked me that question yesterday, and I expressed our position.
Okay, well, let me ask you a more specific question then. The Hong Kong system is not a wholly democratic one, but it has democratic elements. Does the Secretary General support the continuation of those democratic parts of the Hong Kong system of governance?
I think my answer to you yesterday covers your question today.
Well, it wasn't. It was a general comment about democracy in the world, which is what you resort to when you speak about China every single time.
I don't think that's fair. I would ask you to look at the transcript from yesterday. Okay.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.